You are listening to the Scholarship of Inclusive Education podcast. I'm your host, Tim Lawman, from Concordia University College of Alberta in Edmonton, Canada. The Scholarship of Inclusive Education podcast is a series of succinct interviews on important research, theoretical, or philosophical contributions to inclusive education, featuring the scholars who made those contributions. How can we best work in other countries to improve inclusive education practice? My guest today, UK-based Professor Richard Rose, has written extensively about his experiences of research and consulting in the area of inclusive education in varied international and cultural contexts, including Ireland, India, Malaysia, Singapore, China, Estonia, Georgia, Armenia, Finland, and Hong Kong, where he was Marden Fellow and visiting professor at the Institute of Education in 2007. Professor Rose has offered insights into how we should work with students, colleagues, and families engaged in inclusive education work that may or may not differ significantly to contexts we may experience on a regular basis. Following a lengthy career as a teacher, head teacher, and local authority inspector in Britain, Professor Rose joined the faculty at Northampton University, where he is Professor of Inclusive Education and Director of the Centre for Education and Research. Professor Rhodes, thank you for coming on the Scholarship of Inclusive Education podcast. Can you please tell me a little bit about your background?
Okay, I suppose like a lot of people in this country of my age, I was the first one of my family to benefit from higher education. Came from quite a working class background where traditionally people would have left school and gone into industry or into commerce. And to have aspirations to go into higher education was something that very few people from the area I lived in ever had. So I was fortunate enough to get an education beyond school and always kind of valued the fact that I'd had opportunities that maybe earlier generations of my family didn't have. And that, I think, to a large extent, shaped some of my own feeling about what education was about and the opportunities it could provide. And I think because of that as well, right the way through my last years in school, my choices were two, really, career-wise, things that I thought about doing. One was journalism. I could have become a journalist, and the other was to go into school and be a teacher. But the school I went to gave me lots of opportunities. So I did work placements, as we call them here in the UK, in a couple of schools and enjoyed the experience working with young people. Had opportunities to get involved with various youth groups. And that seemed to be the right kind of path for me. So I think in many ways, my own background has shaped a lot of my own feelings about the opportunities that we provide to young people nowadays. And I see that I've been extremely fortunate as a result of my education. I've got to meet a lot of interesting people, do work that I enjoy, visit parts of the world that I could never, ever have imagined as a child could have happened to me. So I think, you know, that's always been very important in my life.
Thanks, Richard. Can you tell me a little bit about what brought you to the study of inclusive education?
Yeah, this was very interesting. I think, again, partly through my own experiences of school, I was aware that I had friends who perhaps struggled a bit more in school than I did. And because of that, sometimes got written off by some of the teachers in the school. I remember, for instance, friends I had who I thought were really quite bright and very able. But because they weren't bright and able in the way the school wanted them to be, they seemed to stand out as being a bit of a nuisance, somebody who school wasn't really suited to. And I think I took that with me when I trained as a teacher. And then my very first teaching job was in a mining community in South Derbyshire in the kind of North Midlands of England. And then I remember my first ever parents' evening. There were two kinds of parents, I felt, who came through the door, and they would sit opposite me, and some of them would say, "I'm a minor, all my family are miners. My brother's a miner. My father was a miner. My grandfather was a miner. So when he goes down the pit, when he leaves school, he isn't going to need to know all this education. You know, he's going to be a miner, just like me, because that's what we do as a family. And then the next parent would say something like, look, I'm a miner and all my family are miners. And the last thing I want is for my son to go down the pit. And his way out of the pit is education. He's got to get the best education he can. And that really kind of moved me, I think, as a teacher, to think, you know, this is education as an escape route for some people.
Our topic today is international collaborations in inclusive education. Can you please tell me a little bit about your work in this area?
Yeah, I think like a lot of people, like I know you, yourself in this position, I've been very fortunate in having opportunities to travel and to meet people of similar interest and working in education in different parts of the world. But in recent years, I think I've thought a lot about why we do this and what the purpose is, and came to the conclusion that if we're going to be honest about the work we do, we actually have to start the kind of partnerships that are sustainable. I've become quite uncomfortable with what I would call the kind of hit-and-miss approach to inclusive education. You know, fly an academic in, they perhaps give a keynote at a conference, talk to teachers in a couple of schools, and then fly out and maybe never visit the place again. And I think I questioned quite seriously what the purpose of that was. Who was benefiting? I think undoubtedly the academic benefits from that experience. But simply going and dropping words of wisdom from the West, as it were, I don't think is going to have much benefit for anybody outside of a very small number of people. So I've been looking for some time to do something which was a bit more sustainable. And I think I was fortunate in 1998, I met an Indian principal of a school, a very interesting man, when I was actually at a conference in the United States in Fort Lauderdale. And we got talking about the fact that he was head of a school full of privileged children, literally children of millionaires in some cases in India. And he himself was questioning what they could put back into the local community. And he invited me to go and do some work in the school. And I went back several times over the next few years and did some kind of voluntary work in the school and in other schools in the community, and started to think that maybe the way to do something which is sustainable really is to build a relationship with one place as much as you can, to spend a bit of time learning about that place, visiting schools, getting to know the people, and then working with them to design the kind of interventions that will work within their context and which they feel they have some control over. And the element of control for me is very important. I think I've seen well-meaning and genuinely well-meaning, well-intentioned people who have gone to countries and tried to put systems in place. But they faltered quite badly, I think, because the ownership of these systems remain with the people who devise them. Whereas if you can work with people and they say, look, this is our situation, this is what we think, can you help us to shape that? And work alongside them and make sure that they're always in the driving seat. They're taking the lead and you're there as a kind of a critical friend, helping them to shape their thinking, helping them to develop their ideas. I think that's far more sustainable. I'll give you an example. One of my very first visits to India, I went to a government school, which schools run by the state and tend to draw children from the poorer communities. And I was greeted at the door by a young, very enthusiastic teacher. And she said, oh, I read a paper you wrote. She was doing a course at the time, University of Bangalore. She said, I read this paper you wrote about the management of group work to support diverse learners. And I'm really interested in this paper. Can you come into my class and tell me how I should organize group work? And I went into her class and she had 80 children. And I just have to say, look, I don't know where to start. I haven't got a clue. I've never taught a class of 80 children in my life. So, you know, let's spend a bit of time talking about it and working out what it is that you would like to achieve. And let's learn from each other and try and shape something that we can do together. I've been back in that school many times and really impressed with the work that they do there. And I've learned so much from that opportunity. So now, you know, I have taught a class of 80 children on a few occasions. And believe me, I still find it incredibly difficult and very, very challenging.
So who has influenced your work?
Yeah, this is a really interesting question for me because I think I've been influenced on lots of different levels. I think, for instance, over the last perhaps 15 years, in terms specifically of the inclusive education agenda, people like Roger Slee have shaped my thinking quite considerably because I think he's moved away almost from the inclusion agenda. I mean, he asks the difficult questions like, you know, who is excluded rather than who's included and what is the nature of exclusion? And that has really interested me, this idea of turning questions around. And I think, you know, Rogers made a very important link between the idea of inclusion as a social justice agenda and inclusion as a kind of practical pedagogical necessity in schools. So Roger certainly influenced my thinking there. I think there are quite a number of people from outside of education though shaped my thinking in terms of the international work. People like Martha Nussbaum, for instance, with her social justice agenda. I've been very interested in the kind of ethics of working with other people that she's written about. And that's certainly shaped some of my thinking there. Similarly, I would say people like Edward Said, you know, who sadly died a few years ago, but, you know, taught us an awful lot about the way we view ourselves in terms of our relationship with people, particularly when we're in positions of influence and power. And I suppose, like a lot of people from the UK, well, I hope like a lot of people in the UK, I feel quite uncomfortable about the notion of some kind of imperialistic approach. You know, I think I'm not saying everything that the British Empire did was bad, but, you know, we have spent a lot of time telling other people what to do and assuming some kind of air of superiority. And that's something which reading people like Edward Said, I've been very aware of, and it's hopefully influence the way that I've worked. But I suppose the other thing is, because I've worked in India for so long, I've looked quite closely at the kind of Indian psyche and the people who've had greatest effect on issues of social justice in India. And from an educational point of view, Rabindranath Tagore and the work that he did at Santiniketan and his notion that education was much broader than what we can get from a book, which is, I think, is very important in the kind of context I work. And also, you know, I would hope that the kind of, I don't know if it's philosophy really, but the kind of thoughts of people like Gandhi and Vinoba Bhave have shaped the kind of notion I've got that what education should be about from our perspective is one of service rather than becoming the kind of expert in going and dispensing words of wisdom. So I think an awful lot of influences on the way that I approach work. In terms of the content of my work, I would say the greatest influences on me have been the teachers that I've worked with. I think like a lot of people in our position, I've sometimes started from a position of naivety and thought, well, I've seen lots of teachers doing this and it's worked. And then tried it and it hasn't. And I think sometimes having the kind of humility to say, this isn't working, let's talk about it, it's quite important. And I find that teachers I work with are very receptive to that kind of approach and are quite prepared to say to me, because of that, that isn't going to work and it isn't going to work because of this. And that's sometimes a really good starting point for us to sit and listen to teachers about their views of what will work. And, you know, also parents and children, giving them an opportunity to express what they feel about things, I think is very important.
What do you think your most important contribution to theory in the area of inclusive education has been so far?
I think many of us who have similar feelings about the rights of children have maybe made a collective contribution to enabling them to have a voice and to be heard and to support people sometimes in getting that voice to places where it's sometimes seen as uncomfortable, where there are people who don't want to hear. So I would hope partly through the work that I've done with other people, certainly not anything I've done entirely on my own, but the kind of collaborations that I've had with people like yourself, for instance, and Chris Forlin and folks when we've worked on various projects together, I think the contribution we've made is perhaps to try and reach a slightly wider audience and to make them more aware of the challenges that many young people and families are facing today.
And what do you see as being the practical outcome of your work?
Okay, I think in terms of the work that I've done in Ireland, for instance, one of the outcomes that I hope has been achieved is to give maybe a more detailed picture of some of the, what I would call, positive initiatives that have been taken for children. I would hope that the work that I've done with colleagues like Michael Shevlin in Ireland, for instance, has done a lot to identify interesting practice in school. I'm always slightly wary of the term good practice because I'm not convinced that necessarily good practice in one school would work always in another. But we've seen teachers who are very innovative, teachers who've given an immense commitment to their classes and have tried ideas that have resulted in children having good learning experiences. So, I think that's been one outcome of the Irish work that we've done to disseminate the practice that we see in schools. I would hope in terms of the India work, one of the outcomes of that has been maybe having a greater number of people on board with a positive attitude towards children. This is quite hard in an Indian context. It's a country which is still, to some extent, in awe of suspicion and superstition. Lots of kind of mythology around why children are like they are, children who we would describe as being on the autistic spectrum, seen as in some way kind of possessed almost. And it means that an awful lot of people have put these children out of sight. You know, there are many families where these children never leave the doors. And a lot of teachers who over recent years have been saying, these children are not my responsibility. They're ineducable, as we would have said back kind of 30 years ago in this country. These children can't be taught. And gradually, because we've built a network of people in India, certainly not just myself. There are tremendous people in India who've been doing this work longer than me, people like Jayanti Narayan, for instance. But I think networking there has actually brought a group of people together.
Have there been any criticisms of your work?
Yeah, there have been criticisms. I think one of the particular criticisms that I've faced, I think from colleagues in Europe and perhaps Western society, has been over the issue of what we mean by inclusion. I think, like a lot of people of our generation who've worked in this field, I've had the view that, inclusive education was about giving every child a learning opportunity and preferably to learn alongside their peers all the time. And that's been at times challenged, that whole view. And because of that, I think I've sometimes put myself in slightly difficult positions For example, you know, I could take you to communities where children have never been to school, and the only way they're going to get an education is possibly through some specialist provision. And I've seen that very much as a stepping stone towards getting those children into a mainstream provision. But I believe in some communities I work in, and for some of the teachers and the parents in those communities, to suddenly say, your child's never been to school, we're going to put them into the local village school, could be a recipe for disaster. I think it would be a bridge too far for many of the teachers. Now, I think it's something we have to aspire to, and it's something I think we've got to move towards. We've got to get to that point. But I think sometimes I've seen really committed teachers in specialist provision that if you and I saw it in Canada or in the UK, we would say, why on earth are these children in this provision? You know, these children ought to be taking their place in the mainstream. But I don't think we can go at the accelerated rate that we're going in our own communities where you and I live. And I've said that on occasions and have been kind of shot down for it, that, you know, there's no halfway house to inclusion. You know, you're either in or you're out. And by putting these kids in this segregated provision, they're out. I feel uncomfortable with that because I don't want these children to be rejected totally. I want somebody to say, we can do something with these kids, we can provide them with an education.
And what do you see as being the next steps for your work, Richard?
For me, this notion of maybe making sure that my work is narrowly focused geographically, I think is really quite critical. I think it takes a long time to move forward, and that means making a long-term commitment, which means perhaps that you've got to turn your back on some of the other exciting opportunities that are out there. But, you know, I think that's quite important to me. I think exploring new means of sharing ideas is really important for me. You know, I'm conscious, for instance, with the students I work with in India, that I'm out there for intensive blocks of time. And it's a really exciting process. We come together, we share ideas, we do lots of interesting activities. And then I go away. And everybody's full of enthusiasm, but keeping that enthusiasm going is really quite critical to moving forward. So looking at ways of sharing information, provoking debate and ideas, hence, for instance, putting up a blog, the idea was to kind of not be provocative. I don't mean provocative in the sense of putting up things that are going to upset people, but putting up things that provoke ideas, I think is really quite important. And, you know, if people can access that kind of thing, and, you know, the great thing is, as I say, I maintain this blog. It was intended for students in India. It's so far been accessed by people in over 40 countries. And they don't all post, but there's an opportunity there if we can work out better systems, I think, to put my students in India in touch with you in Canada, for instance, which some of them have been through that approach, and to see that, you know, they can share these ideas. And what I'd really like to do is to put people in India in touch with people maybe in some Middle Eastern countries or in South America, in countries with similar economic situations, so that they can actually share ideas and see that, you know, that there's a commonality to what we're doing there. So I think that's really important for kind of next step for me, along with some kind of evaluation of what we're doing. You know, it feels good at the moment. It feels, you know, when I go there, I feel listening to teachers and seeing what they produce and looking at what they're doing in school, I think, yeah, this is having an impact. You know, there are teachers now who are going in and are saying, you know, I'm kind of not just teaching to the middle line anymore. I'm trying to differentiate my lessons. I'm trying different approaches to teaching. I'm asking children what they think about what I'm doing and getting their opinions on what it is that I do that helps or impedes their learning. And I'm thinking, yeah, this is great. But we could do it in a more formal way. I think for me, one of the things to look at is a way of actually evaluating that and to see not just is it having impact now, but is it going beyond the people we're working with, and can it be maintained in that in the different situations and see what's going on. So they're the kind of priorities I have at the moment.
And where do you see inclusive education going in the future?
Yeah, this is a really challenging situation at the moment, I think. As I said just now, I do worry that as economies have struggled and politicians have looked at ways of saving money, that inclusion is no longer as high on the agenda as it used to be. I've had a politician say to me quite openly in this country that these children are becoming a burden upon our education system. You know, they're costing us a lot of money. He could even give me figures of how much more it cost to educate a child with learning difficulties than it was to educate other children. And he was saying, you know, we have to get out of this mess, and that means we need well-educated, skilled school leavers. And the kind of kids that you're concerned about are not going to be come into that category. So I do have a real worry about that. And the marketization of education, certainly in my country, means that schools are being judged in terms of their academic performance, and children who can't actually impact positively upon those outcomes, in some cases, are being viewed as an undesirable element within the school. So I worry about that. On the other hand, I'm an optimist because I see such professional teachers with such commitment to the children in front of them. And I see teachers now who maybe 10 years ago would have been quite opposed to the idea of having certain children in their class, who've gone through that and have rationalised it and are actually doing tremendous work with the very kids who they didn't want to have in the class a few years ago. So there's a degree of optimism for me in there. But, you know, I think we are going to go through a very challenging period in the immediate future.
Professor Richard Rose, thank you very much for appearing on the Scholarship of Inclusive Education podcast.
Okay, you're very welcome, Tim, and good luck with this this project. And I look forward to hearing to it from other people that contribute.
For more resources related to the featured academics on the podcast, please visit the podcast website at education.concordia.ab.ca/inclusion podcast. You may contact me by email at tim.lawman@concordia.ab.ca.